Welcome. We're glad you've joined us for this Hand in Hand podcast. Hand in Hand is a nonprofit organization, and we provide information, classes, training, and lots of support for parents like you. We call our approach Parenting by Connection, and it's based on the insight that you deserve good support as you parent, and every child needs lots of connection in order to thrive. We offer tools to help you foster support for yourself and connection in your family. We hope this podcast gives you exactly the kind of support you're looking for.
Welcome, folks, to Partnering Well in Parenting. We're glad you're here. We're excited about this call. I'm Patty Whipler, and I'm the founder and the program director at Hand in Hand Parenting. And with me is Teresa Kelleher, one of our instructors. And I'm going to introduce in just a moment our guests tonight who are going to give you lots of really good information. We are going to take a little bit of time to talk about hand-in-hand parenting in the very beginning, and Ellen Bader and Peter Pearson are going to talk about the Couples Institute for just a couple minutes. So we're glad you're here. We're excited about this call. So just a few things about Hand in Hand. We're a nonprofit organization. Our mission is to make parenting go well, to help parents connect well with their children, to help children get the connection and the love and the support that we parents intend to give them. And in order to make that happen, we have 6 listening tools that we teach parents, and we teach them and talk about them in articles on the website, in these teleseminars, in our blog posts, in our classes, building emotional understanding classes, and in everything we do. And we know that you're working really hard as parents. We know that it's probably the most important thing that you will ever do, the raising of your children and the loving of your children, and we're here to try to help that go well. We're here to try to support you in particular. Parents really need and deserve emotional support for the emotional work of parenting. And our website is handinhandparenting.org. And I want to introduce Dr. Ellen Bader and Dr. Peter Pearson, who are married and who have founded the Couples Institute, and they train therapists internationally to counsel couples well. Ellen and Pete, welcome. I'm so glad you're with us.
Ah, it's good to be here. And I just want to say, Patty, when you work with your spouse and you have kids, you have so many opportunities. It's unbelievable to practice what you preach.
So yes, I'd like you to just, Ellen and Pete, if you would just tell people a little bit about the Couples Institute, and then go ahead and we'll ask you a first question, and we can dive into
the
partnering well part of parenting. Yeah.
Pete and I founded the Couples Institute together in 1984 at a time when couples therapy was not even a specialty yet. And I actually got into it because I did a lot of family therapy, and I saw how much the couples needed in terms of needing to be able to stay connected while they were parenting. And so we started the Couples Institute with a goal of helping couples create really flourishing, successful, loving relationships, and also to prevent premature and unnecessary divorces, and to train therapists all around the world to be able to support and know what they were doing when they were working with couples. And I think one of the best things to tell about the Couples Institute is that when Pete and I started it, we knew we wanted to do something together, but we didn't know what that was. So we called it X, and for about a year we explored all kinds of possibilities and ideas of what we might do, all the way from building houseboats in India and bringing them into the United States to different aspects of therapy. And we ended up deciding that our passion really was helping couples create those flourishing relationships.
Actually, Ellen, as you talk about that, later on in this call, we're going to talk to you about this concept of goals that excite the imagination and how important that is for couples to have, which is goals that excite the imagination. And when Ellen and I were first brainstorming about what to do, we wanted to do something together but didn't know what it was. And we'd sit in the backyard, we'd have a glass of wine, and we'd say, well, what about a restaurant? And the other person would say, well, what about a restaurant that appeals to you? And we talk about that and say, well, that doesn't look like it has a lot of life. What else is exciting to you? And out of that ongoing brainstorming, we came up with, let's specialize in working with couples. And out of that original dream, let's just specialize in working with couples, we have an institute where we have 10 other therapists who work for us. We train therapists literally in at least 20 or 30 different countries, but it's all based on that original dream. What do you want to do that excites you, honey?
Might be good to add, too, that we have a book that we've written for the public called Tell Me No Lies, How to Face the Truth and Build a Loving Marriage. And it's not just about lies and deception, but it's really about what it takes over the long haul to have a thriving marriage.
And to be honest with compassion. Truth with compassion is growth, and telling the truth without compassion is pain. And so what we want to do is help couples learn, help them each express their own truth with compassion that leads to growth.
Okay. Let's dive in. So I'd like to hear, I think, from Ellen, perhaps, what's your quick take on some of the stresses on a couple that occur as a result of parenting? Like there's couples with children, couples without. What happens to the couple?
All right. So
Patty, there's probably nothing we could say that you haven't already covered, but go ahead, Ellen.
No, I think, you know, as soon as a couple brings a child into their relationship, almost immediately they're signing up for sleep deprivation and fatigue.
And sleep deprivation amplifies every possible problem you can think of.
And the amazing thing, I think there's a great line actually from Marie Chevalier who said, "We pick our partners in dimmer light than we would ever pick our wardrobes." And when people have kids, all of a sudden we start to discover things about our partners that we really didn't have any idea about. So, and there's so many areas. It's like what the kids are going to eat. How are we going to spend time together? Do we do everything as a family? Do we do things with each child separately? All kinds of interesting values pop up. It can be something as simple as one who absolutely insists that the child play a musical instrument, to a parent who wants both parents to be involved in community and volunteer work and the other parent doesn't really want to do it. There's tremendous anxiety often about providing financial support for the family. And so couples have this dilemma that shows up very quickly of how do we stay connected as a couple while we're raising our kids. And I thought I would just share before we go on a couple of things, because staying connected, people often think of as being hugely time-consuming for a couple. And it can be really short, simple things like taking a photo on your iPhone and sending it off to your partner of something you're doing, and that way you're including them. It can be the hug you give each other when you reunite at the end of the day. It can be sharing appreciations and finding an activity that you can enjoy briefly together at home, like doing a crossword puzzle together. So it doesn't have to be something that's, you know, a whole date night or a very time-consuming thing. And we'll talk more about other ways to stay connected when you've got negotiation to do, problem-solving to do. But that's just a way to get you to begin to think about fun little quick things, even short texts during the day that say, hey, I'm thinking of you, or I love you, or you matter to me.
But it's an interesting thing, Patty, about before kids come along, you can talk about each other. You negotiate who wants to do what for a weekend or an evening or where to go for dinner or what to have for dinner, et cetera. But as soon as kids show up, all of a sudden the focus goes from the couple to roles and responsibilities around parenting, chores, and the logistics under the house. And, boy, if that's not a huge change. Woo!
So, Pete, this is Teresa. And so clearly problems do come up. And what would you say? How can couples talk about a problem without creating any more tension on top of the tension that's already there with the, you know, kids coming on board?
Well, listen, I will give you, it's a good introduction to a process that we teach couples that when they come in, often in the first or second session, and you name it, they struggle with talking about child rearing, sex, finances, chores, clutter, in-laws, etc. And I give them a way of talking about those problems that in the first session they sound like they are graduates of professional communication courses. And curiously enough, as I learned more about hand-in-hand, and this was one of the skills that you talk for parents to children called stay listening, I think, that there's a great parallel to that that couples can have, which all of a sudden takes the sting out of talking about problems. And the first step in talking about problems is for each person to be able to have their say on what the problem is. And often when one person is describing their stress on a particular problem, the other person, the listening partner, feels defensive. They want to blame. They want to justify. They want to explain. And that just leads to a go-nowhere discussion. So here's what I tell couples that amazingly seems to have a quick parallel with stay listening, one of the skills that you teach. Here's what I tell couples. And if you guys who are listening to this, get this and practice it in the next conversation with your partner. And if they're not on the phone and you practice this, your partner's going to think, oh, my God, you are a hero or heroine. Here's what I mean. In almost any or every discussion a couple has where there's a repeating fight or an argument, every repeating argument that lasts more than 30 seconds has two things in common. Number one, one person or the other or both are trying to boss the partner, which means they're telling their partner what to do or what not to do. And when we're getting bossed, when we're being told what to do or what not to do, we get automatically defensive. The second common denominator of every argument or fight that lasts longer than 30 seconds is one or the other or both people are making their partners wrong in some way. And that immediately triggers our defensiveness. We want to explain, justify, or just get out of there, shut down and say, I don't even want to talk about it. So I say to couples, here's what I want you to do. You guys want to talk about X problem, and it could be money, sex, chores, clutter, in-laws, doesn't make any difference, vacations. I say, one of you decides who's going to be the speaker, who's going to be the listener. They decide, okay, Charlie's going to be the listener, Sue is going to be the speaker. And I say, Charlie, when Sue is talking, here's the attitude I want you to have. I want you to listen where you don't have to think you have to change a thing. This is a no change. I don't want you to feel guilty. I don't want you to feel shame. I don't want you to feel blamed. This is your partner just talking to you. You don't have to change a thing. This is no blame, no change way of listening. I want you to listen just like your partner is a passenger on an airplane and you have a long ride, you don't know them, and they want to talk about the stresses they're having in their marriage. You got no skin in the game. You're just going to listen, and because you got no skin in the game, you can listen with curiosity, with empathy, with understanding. You can ask questions, you can recap what you're hearing, but I want you to listen where you don't feel, in this discussion, blamed. You don't have to change, you don't have to feel guilty, you don't have to feel shamed. I just want you to listen with that attitude. And the overwhelming majority of people who actually adopt that attitude can listen to their partner and give them a priceless gift of listening while their partner expresses their anguish, their agony, their pain, their anger, etc. And when Charlie can listen with the attitude of no blame, no change, all of a sudden his partner begins to feel like, man, they can contain, they can hold, they can hear, they can empathize and be curious. What a gift. And automatically, when you experience your partner listening like that, you begin to calm down. You begin to express yourself differently because the partner's not defensive. They're not justifying. They're not explaining. They're not cross-complaining. It's an extraordinary gift that you can give your partner by thinking in your own head, no blame, no change, no guilt, no shame. That makes the ability to listen a gift to your partner. It's an extraordinary experience or exercise for couples to practice.
And Patty, isn't that kind of very similar to some of the ideas that you've built into listening partnerships?
Yes. We ask parents to listen with warmth and respect. And we acknowledge that the most difficult person, oftentimes, for most parents to listen to that in that way is their partner. The burdens on parents are enormous. And what happens is that we look for emotional safety. We look for somebody that we feel safe with and then try to offload the emotional heat that collects because we're doing a hard job in under difficult circumstances. And oftentimes the person we pick to listen to all of our emotional heat is the person we married.
And who's the most affected by our emotional.
Along with that emotional heat, Patty, comes, and honey, you need to, ... And as soon as somebody hears the you need to, whatever, that's what creates the defensiveness, which is why I tell people to listen with the attitude that they don't have to change. Then they can listen with warmth and respect.
And where a listening partnership can come in handy for people who are working on their relationship is they can find a listener who's not a part of the family, and they can storm and scream and yell and curse, and they can blame and shame.
That's right. That's the good thing, because it's not going to affect the person they're talking to.
And that's exactly the way I want a spouse to listen to their partner.
Yes,
is, hey, I got no skin in this game. I can listen.
Uh-huh. And once you can get the emotional heat out of the way, once you can have a good cry or have a good stomp, then your mind clears and you're not so full of emotional static, and at that point you're much easier to it's much easier to make decisions. It's much easier to let somebody else be themselves, which is kind of what we need to do with one another.
I was thinking as you two were talking that a parent who has a listening partner that they can unload with first and then also talk to their partner, but really still have some of the emotion left in it, is probably the very best off of all.
Well, see, I just, Patty, want to underline the value of listening to our partners with warmth and respect, but it's easier to do that if you have the attitude of you don't have to change. Because when we're listened to, we begin to, as people, we begin to unfold and expand, and ideas begin to grow within us and come to life, but only when we feel safe that we're listened to.
That's right. Yeah. Great. Ellen, how about power struggles? That's something that seems to happen a lot between couples. And do you recommend an approach to decision-making around to reduce power struggles?
I certainly do. And this is going to be a lot of content here for a minute, but we really think that when a couple has difficult decisions to make, and every couple, because it is the most interdependent relationship that any of us will ever have in our lives. I mean, we are interdependent with our spouses in terms of, everything basically that we're doing. So there's going to be conflict, and it's so, so essential for couples to learn how to deal with their conflicts and with their differences. And we offer couples actually three different types of decisions when they're in a power struggle. And if you can take time or you find yourself in a power struggle or a significant conflict with your spouse and you say, okay, which one of these three types of decisions makes the most sense for us to use? And I want to run through those, because the first type is an equilateral decision, and that means basically that both partners are going to decide and that nothing is going to be implemented until both partners agree. And there are good things and there are bad things about equilateral decisions.
Those are 50-50 decisions.
Exactly.
Each has exactly the same voice, and nothing gets advanced until both people agree with it.
And so the reality is that equilateral decisions often take the most time, because you really are taking the time to explore what matters to each person and find out about motivation. So there's often more conflict or more opportunity for conflict initially. The good side is that when couples hang in there and make an equilateral decision, a 50-50 decision, that both partners are going to buy into it, and they're less likely to have lingering conflict afterwards. And typical things that couples want to make equal decisions about are potentially their budget, or if they're going to move into a new house, both people want to have an equal say about that. What schools kids go to, all those kinds of things. How you spend holidays, many of those are things people want to make equal decisions about. The second type of decision making is the unilateral decision. And in a unilateral decision, what you have is one partner who's making the decision with actually little input needed from the other, or maybe not even desired from the other. The good thing about unilateral decisions is that they greatly reduce conflict up front.
And reduce a lot of discussion up front.
Yeah. And sometimes just some of the roles and responsibilities around the house can go much smoother if one person does have unilateral decision making. And some typical things like that, we use some of the sex role stereotypes, but often it is men or fathers who handle financial investments. It's more common for mothers to be the ones who choose the babysitters, maybe who even arrange the social calendar, maybe how the kitchen gets arranged. Now, another thing, though, about unilateral decision-making is when it's decided up front, the person who gets to make the decision carries both the authority for making the decision and also the responsibility for doing the work that's connected to that decision. And as long as there's consent between the two partners, again, these are really useful decisions. Unfortunately, couples can get into enormous difficulty when one person makes a unilateral decision on something that both people think is an equal decision. Single worst example of that is when is infidelity. When a couple has a monogamous agreement and a marriage, and then one partner goes out and has an affair. But on a much more mundane level than that can be things like somebody just all of a sudden goes and spends a whole lot of money on something that only one partner wants, and they go buy what they want and they do it unilaterally, especially when budget is tight. Then those kinds of decisions actually end up in a whole lot of conflict. The third type of decision is one that we like a lot in some specific situations, and it's what we call the 51-49% decision-making strategy. And this is a decision-making strategy that saves an incredible amount of conflict. And it's a decision-making strategy that can be used well when partners do trust each other. In this case, it's decided up front that one partner has the final decision-making authority. And so...
And it's about a decision that affects both people.
Right. Good examples of things in this arena are things like remodeling or changing the house around in some way, where there's a lot of work connected to a particular task, and typically, you know, our living space can be something that touches into very primitive parts of ourselves, and we can tend to fight a lot with our partners about how's it going to look or what colors are going to be the room going to be painted in. And so sometimes partners can decide up front that one person has that final authority to make decisions, and they do have the responsibility to do the primary amount of the work. However, there's an understanding that they will strongly take into account what the other person desires.
Or even request it.
Well, yeah, they'll request input, and they'll use the input. They still get the final decision-making, and they may end up deciding, I'm going to paint the room red even though you hate red, but usually they would not do that. I mean, usually they would take in and utilize the desires of the other person, but still make an effective decision that enables the whole room to be decorated in some way. And so if you think about a conflict continuum from low to high so that you don't have power struggles, the lowest amount of conflict that you're ever going to have is when there's unilateral decisions with agreement. Next is when you do 51-49% decision-making strategy. Then as you go up the conflict continuum, equilateral decisions are very likely to have some significant conflict in them. And then, of course, the worst and the ones that have the most enduring resentment and have the hardest time for people to get over are when unilateral decisions get made without agreement.
A quick example is, Ellen used the notion of remodeling, and a lot of couples have a lot of fights over remodeling. When we put an addition on the house, Ellen and I made two decisions. One is, what would the budget be, and what type of decision would we have? And we decided it would be a 51-49. And because Ellen was going to put more energy and had more investing in what the addition would look like, she would get 51% of the vote. So she would ask me opinions about, Pete, do you want this or do you want that? Do you prefer this? Do you prefer that? And she'd take my opinion, my desires into consideration, and then make a decision. And one time we were talking about, I think it was, I don't know, faucets or something like that. And I said, Ellen, I saw these faucets. I thought they were really, really cool. And she said, oh, thanks for your feedback. That's already been decided. And because Ellen had most of the responsibility, she gets 51% of the vote. And I would just say, okay, all right.
And we only learned that the hard way after doing a different job a few years earlier where we had a lot of conflict. And so we learned from that experience and said, okay, we don't want to repeat that. So how are we going to go into this one differently?
What really annoys couples if they do a project like that is one person will come home and say, I have three choices here for this. What do you think, honey? I don't like any of those three. Go get three more. And after a while, that becomes really irritating for the person who's taking the initiative and the responsibility. So the 51-49 can, when you decide that's what's going to happen, you don't mind asking your partner for input because you get the last vote. If you're the 51 person, you don't mind asking. You don't mind their input. You welcome it. And then you decide. And there's no fighting over the decision because that's what you agreed upon ahead of time.
Does that make sense, Teresa?
It does. Now, I'm thinking, you know, in a lot of what we think as parents are important parenting decisions to make, a lot of times I think couples agree that they're equal, 50-50 decisions. But they still can't come to an agreement. So are there good ways that you suggest to negotiate, you know, when you can't reach an agreement, what are good ways to negotiate that?
Well, see, I think couples often treat decisions as 50-50 when one person is actually doing most of the work. And when one person does most of the work, most of the time we think the person who does most of the research, most of whatever, they should get 51% of the vote. But when one person does a vast majority of the work and their partner wants 50% of the vote, that's inherently unfair. So they really need to get clear. Is this equilateral, 50-50, 51, or 51-49? And that discussion is worthwhile.
I think, Teresa, you're asking about maybe discipline issues or limit-setting issues where parents really absolutely feel like they have they need to have an equal say, and they don't agree. I mean, some of the most difficult conflicts that I've worked with parents on is when one parent really believes in spanking and the other one doesn't, right. And they have to negotiate that. So I think you're asking us, like, okay, how do you move into negotiation?
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, actually, people who are listening to this can get a link, and I don't know how you're going to post it, but we'll get a link to, it's a document that Ellen and I wrote called Super Negotiation for Couples. And it's a 4-page document that talks about negotiation, what can be negotiated, and what cannot be negotiated. And interestingly enough, you can't negotiate values, you can't negotiate principles, you can only negotiate behavior, which means who's going to do what, by when, and according to what standard. And there's probably the toughest, the biggest challenge up front when you're negotiating something is to avoid doing what most couples do, which is to say, well, the problem is, and then fill in the blank. It can be around chores, parenting, budgets, sex, visiting in-laws, vacations, etc. And the problem is, and the thing about defining it as a problem is you almost can't avoid defining something as a problem without pointing a finger at your partner or yourself, and that automatically creates defensiveness. So if, actually, we could do this. If there's anybody on who's listening who says, I think we have a problem negotiating X, and I will give you a way, if somebody has that, I can offer you a way of how to define the issue without creating defensiveness. So if somebody is listening and says, you know what, we have trouble negotiating X, and speak up if you can put them on, I'll give you a way of defining it, which
okay.
reduces the initial defensiveness.
Great. So if you have such a problem, hit *2 on your phone, and I'll be able to see that you want to stump Pete.
And maybe I'll say just one or two little things while people are thinking, but this is a great opportunity for you to have Pete help you change the way you might bring up something with your partner. Because a couple of the things that people do often when they have something to negotiate is that they cave in too quickly to avoid the tension or to keep the peace. And so maybe you know you have a problem with your partner, but you don't take the risk of bringing it up. Or sometimes
you cave in too quickly just because you're a pleasing personality, you're an over-accommodator, you're an over-adapter, and so you cave in too quickly with the down-the-road price of you're going to resent the agreement that you came to.
Another thing that many partners do is they stubbornly push way too hard for their own side and aren't able to listen well to what the other person wants. And the last problem is often a failure to prepare well before the negotiation with how you're going to bring it up. And that's exactly what Pete's going to help somebody with right now, is how you would actually prepare and how you would define the problem.
Okay. So someone from Florida has raised their hand, so go ahead, please.
Is that me?
That would be you, Florida. What's your name?
Oh, okay. My name is Maggie.
All right, Maggie.
Hi. So the biggest issue that my husband and I butt heads about, we have 2 children, and we have an issue over their health. I'm a physician, and my husband's a teacher. And
what could possibly go wrong?
Right? Okay, yeah. So for instance, my husband, like, for instance, if my kid has a cough, if it's a little cough, I don't think they're sick. But my husband may view it as they're very sick. And I will say, well, really, he doesn't have a fever, you know, he's not, you know, losing weight. You know, like, I'll go through, like, my scientific
right.
explanations, although I have to tell you, my husband is a science high school science teacher. And so
I love it.
And I wish he's not, and so then, you know, or I'll say, well, the doctor said, you know, it's fine as long as he doesn't have fever, you know, like, you know, if my kids are like coughing up a storm, I'm not going to send them in. But if my kids have a cough, and I live in Miami, and if it's 60 degrees, my husband will say, no, you can't send them outside. Or it's raining, and it rains half the year here, no, they can't go outside.
Now, does this sound like a negotiation problem?
Yes, because let me think. I think it becomes a problem when he feels the kids have to stay indoors and have to be treated a certain way. Like, he'll tell me, his argument will be, well, you know, it doesn't matter what science says or medicine says. I believe in the old wives' tale. And I can't,
So here it is, so, Maggie, here it is. In the old way of doing things, if you and your husband were going to have this as a discussion, and you'd bring it up, and you would, in the old way, you'd probably say, honey, I think the problem is, and then how would you go about describing the problem? I think the problem is what?
I think the problem is we have different views of what constitutes illness and and we have different views of when our children can go to school and when they can't. So we just have different definitions of what's healthy.
All right, so actually, that's very good. You're moving in the right direction, so I hope everybody's listening to this. Because you're moving in the right direction.
I've been in Imago therapy for a year. Good for you. So you've learned a lot from
Yes, you have, and it shows. Now, somebody else might say, well, the problem is, and how do you think somebody might say it in an unconstructive way? So how do you think somebody might approach it who is not as enlightened as you are, somebody who might approach the situation that you're describing by saying to their spouse, honey, I think the problem is what?
Well, I guess maybe, and he'll also say, we tried your way and it didn't work, so why can't we do my way?
Yeah, they would say something like, you know what the problem is, honey? You're just too overprotective, you know, around health, and that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? That would be the unconstructive
low
way.
Low constructive, right.
Right. You're just too overprotective. And the other person would say, no, what I think the problem is that you really don't understand that we have to protect the kid's health. And that's the problem.
Yep.
You see what I mean?
We've had that discussion, yes.
Oh, great, great. So, all right, good. You've been there. So you have an idea.
Not protective enough, yeah.
When in the old way, somebody would say the problem is, which means basically pointing a finger.
Right.
Now, in the way that I'm talking about, the way to bring up an issue is to say, honey, we seem to disagree about. And that's going to take a while before both people can agree on what we disagree about. But you came really close, Maggie, when you were saying we seem to disagree about when or how to intervene with the kid's symptoms or health problems. And see, that's a non-blameful way of describing it.
So, in fact, as Pete said, an unconstructive way would be to say you're too overprotective. A much more constructive way is to say we seem to disagree about when to send the kids to school, when they have some symptoms.
We seem to disagree about when they need to go to see a physician. And that way, neither person has to feel defensive or protective of their territory. And that's the first step in negotiation that is constructive and productive, is by getting a definition where neither person feels like they got to protect their position.
Do you want to take one more, or you want to talk a little bit about some more of the successful steps in negotiation?
I'll just give you one more quick example. When Ellen and I first started living together, when it came to clutter, it quickly became apparent that I have a much higher tolerance for visual disarray than Ellen does.
For mess. Mess.
Only
mess.
That's not how Ellen would describe it. She would say, no, the problem is, Pete, you're a pig. And I would say, Ellen, no, the problem is I don't want to live in a museum. You know how people tend to amplify their perspective? Well, when you define it like that, somebody's going to start off being defensive. When we started to define it as we seem to disagree about what constitutes an acceptable letter, a level of clutter or disarray in the living room or the kitchen, we seem to disagree about how much clutter we can live with. That definition does not point fingers, and that's the key. That is the key to starting off negotiation in a good way, is getting a description of the problem that doesn't involve pointing fingers. It takes a while to get there, but it's worth it. And then you start on those four pages that you will get on how to negotiate, and it's kind of like a paint-by-numbers step to go through about how to negotiate stuff, what can be negotiated, what can't be, how to prepare for it, how to think about what happens if your partner gets what they want, what happens when they don't get what they want, how could you support them getting what they want, et cetera, et cetera. But you go back and forth with one person starting off listing their concerns, their interests, their values, and the other person listening, recapping and asking questions, and then switching. When each person feels like they have been understood by their partner after expressing your concerns and interests and values, when both people feel like they have been understood, then you go to the next step. And the next step is what takes into consideration so you don't cave in or don't push too hard for what you want. You make a proposal. One person says, honey, based on what I hear from you and what I've expressed, here's what I would suggest, dot, dot, dot. And the proposal works for me because that means you got to take yourself into consideration. And honey, my proposal, I think, could work for you because after listening to your concerns, here's why my proposal could work for you. And when each person starts expressing solutions that work for themselves and their partner, it becomes a lot more collaborative. Now, here's the thing, is when you do a negotiation, do it as an experiment for a limited period of time. Too many people think the negotiation has to be a forever solution, and then they get too bogged down into, no, I don't want to do that, I don't want to do this, I can't do that. Do it as an experiment for a limited period of time to see how it's working. Then after that period of time, you can come back and say, well, here's what I've learned from what we've done. I learned this unexpectedly, and I learned that. Let's revisit the negotiation based on what we have learned, if it's working out. If you don't need to continue it, you say, hallelujah, we found it. So, but those four pages that you will get on the link from this call will walk you through the steps for how to negotiate collaboratively and cooperatively like you are a team.
Well, and also think about it that solutions evolve over time, so that when you come up with one solution, you can try it out, work with it for a little while, and then add or subtract to that solution. I remember really well a couple who came to see me who were at an impasse, and what happened was she was saying, I just can't stand being in the house. It's just too dark. There's no sun getting in. Being in the kitchen is really depressing. I don't even want to be in there to cook a meal because it's just so dark. And he said, and they had a big, big old tree outside of their kitchen window. And he said, look, there is no way in the world I'm ever going to cut down that tree. I'm a totally a nature lover. I'm not going to kill something that's unnecessary to kill, and I'm just not going to do it. And so they were at a really heated impasse about this. She felt like he didn't care about her level of depression and energy. He felt like she was, you know, going to be a nature killer. And they were dug in and really stuck. And so as Pete was talking about, part of it is slowing down that process and really asking people to talk to each other and understand the emotions that are underneath the content of the problem. So understand what is driving each of them in to get to a solution. And in the case of this particular couple, with many conversations and going slowly about it, he came to understand that she truly did feel depressed without getting more light. She wasn't just trying to do this to barrel over the top of him, but that she really, really, really did need some more and want some more light coming into the house. And she came to understand that he just couldn't live with himself, and he would feel like he had just not been in integrity with values that he had espoused all his whole life if he cut down that tree. And so eventually they came up with a decision, which luckily they could afford, which was creating a really fantastic skylight in their house and into the kitchen, and also creating some different kinds of windows that enabled much more light, and also plants to be planted in the windows in their house. So they ended up with a solution that worked for both of them, that they were both happy with and that worked, but it took a lot of conversations to get there.
That's a really good example. Thank you. So why do parents fight so often about things, you know, things with children, things to do with children like bedtime and, you know, schedules? It's like, what do you think is behind the sort of the run-of-the-mill upsets that happen day to day?
Well, bedtime is one of my bedtime and mealtime, dinner time, are two of the places that I see couples get into a lot of trouble. And I think to make one of the aspects of that clear, I will use some sex role stereotypes again, although it could be either parent in either one of these roles. But I'll say that a typical scenario, especially with young children, is that a mom has been home throughout the day, or she's been transporting kids around. She's, you know, she may have done some play listening. She may have done just different kinds of play with the kids all day long. She's had to deal with, maybe they've had conflicts with each other. By the time she gets to dinner time, she is emotionally drained. Also, often emotionally or physically drained. The kids are tired and cranky, so the kids are not at their best. And then we have the other parent come in. And this can be true in gay and lesbian relationships as well as heterosexual relationships, that the other parent comes home, and the parent coming home actually is coming into the situation from a very different place. Usually they want to come in and unwind first, and that immediately creates a problem, because the parent who's home wants to have just to turn everything over to their returning spouse. But then after that, the parent who's been at work has been taking orders all day long, probably at work, or doing what they have, what the boss says. Or
yeah, their own demands.
Yeah, they have a lot of demands at work, and they don't particularly want their partner to be telling them what to do or how to do it. And the partner's at home is thinking, God, if I can just get a good routine established and get the kids to bed at a reliable time, that will be, you know, that'll make things go smoother, and eventually I'll get a little time to myself. And perhaps the person who's coming home from work may want to roughhouse. In fact, they may love stirring the kids up, and it may offload some tension for them to actually stir the kids up. Too often after they stir them up, they're tired and ready to disappear, and they're leaving the other parent with stirred up kids. So basically what I'm saying is there's just an enormous difference in terms of what each parent is wanting or needing at that time of day. And this is where it takes really good communication, because it takes one parent being able to say something like, all right, I really do want to play in rough house tonight, but I will put them to bed if I go ahead and stir them up. Or the one parent may want to say to the other, look, I am just exhausted. Can I go down the street to a Starbucks and be out of here for half an hour, have a coffee, and then come back, and I'll be rejuvenated? And so the ability to really directly comment and describe your internal desires, and as you get better and better about it, quickly negotiate how you're going to handle that time period. And even better yet is even to develop some routines over time that work well for the kids and for the parents.
It takes discussion and negotiation, collaboration, cooperation, and mutual support. But, you know, I have something just in the interest of time to talk about a really common problem of couples when kids show up, which is beginning to lose the couple connection. And there's a phenomena in nature called the law of entropy, which is totally appropriate for couples. Now, before your eyes glaze over, here's the law of entropy. What it basically says is that all systems, if left unattended, will run down unless new energy is pumped into the organism or the system. The system will disintegrate. So, well, how does that apply to marriage? Whoa, because we get so busy with work, with roles, responsibilities, taking care of kids, that we begin to lose the connection of the couple. And I think one couple actually said to me, they're very articulate, as they were talking about the disintegration of their relationship. They said, we thought the foundation of our marriage was in place, like the foundation of our house, and we didn't need to attend to the foundation of our marriage anymore because we thought it was in place. And they said, basically, our marriage ended up with the equivalent of leaks in the roof, termites, windows that were cracked, and a foundation that needed repair. Yes, our relationship was disintegrating because we were not putting new energy, we're not pumping energy into the system called our marriage. And so the classic is, all right, go on a date night. Date nights are good, but after a while that becomes routine. We have dinner, we talk about the kids, go to a movie. And then that becomes a routine, and it doesn't really energize the couple. So one of the things that we like to give couples when they come in and say, go on a date night, go for a walk, go out for dinner, where you have an opportunity to talk uninterrupted. And we give them a questionnaire. And you can also get the questionnaire on the list of handouts.
Exactly, a list of questions.
And they're questions that couples don't ordinarily think about to have a discussion. Like, honey, when you are in the rocking chair stage of your life and you look back on your life, what are one or two or three regrets that you have as you look back on your life? And most regrets are things that we didn't do over things that we did do. But talk about the regrets, and you have an opportunity before you reach that rocking chair stage of your life, if you wish, to start to correct those regrets. In a sense, it's like a bucket list. What do you want to do before you kick the bucket? But the questionnaire has 20 questions on there, which will help you have discussions about each other that you probably haven't had in years, just to learn about different aspects of who you are and how you are, what you value, what you think about when you're going to work if you're not thinking about work. So that's one thing. The other thing is couples say, well, what do we do on date night if we don't do dinner and a movie? Well, here's what's interesting. When you're first together, the activity is not as important. When you're together, when you're first together and you are so enraptured with each other, you can watch parking meters expire, and that's pretty cool, but not after years of being married. The activity then becomes more important. So if you go down and watch the traffic lights change now, that's not as exciting, but it was when you're first together. So there's a website called Dating Divas. That is really, really cool because it has 200 different ideas for dates to for things to do on date night, depending on the season of the year, activities for inside the house, outside the house, activities that are active, activities that are intellectual. It gives you over 200 ideas that you can do together to start reconnecting in those ways. So that is a really, really good site to go to just to start priming the pump for things to do in addition to the classic dinner and movie. The other things that Ellen and I talk a lot about couples when they come in, and this is really interesting. Couples come in and we talk about why are you here, what brings you here, what are your goals. And as they describe their goals for coming in, then we often ask, so what are you guys going to feel when you reach these goals? And they often say things like, well, that'll feel pretty good. We'll feel okay. That sounds fine. But often when you just feel okay or good, that's not sufficient motivation to keep going when you hit the inevitable snags and rough patches. So I say, I have an idea. Let's talk about goals that excite your imagination. When you think about doing these things, what gets you excited? Goals that you would do individually, together, and as a family. Goals that include things to do, ways to be, and things to have. Goals around doing, being, and having that excite your imagination as an individual, as a couple, as a family, and get the kids involved in this. Sometimes we need goals that include our partner. Sometimes we need things that just excites us that we can pursue that doesn't include our partner. Maybe you like to ski or bowl, and your partner would rather have a stick in the eye than go bowling. Well, that's okay. Go bowling anyway if that's what energizes you. Get the kids involved in family goals. When our daughter was in eighth grade, I thought this was fabulous. Oh, my God, it was fabulous. One of her friends, her parents took this kid out of school when she was in eighth grade. I think it was eighth grade or ninth grade. And they had another son who was in fifth or sixth grade. And they literally went sailing around the world. Talk about an education when you get on a boat, when you sail around the world that you cannot possibly get in the classroom. The classroom on the ocean, going to different ports, cultures, unbelievable. These are goals that really excite the imagination. Now, I know that's a really limited goal for just a really small percent of couples, but it gives you an idea about what it means to have something that excites the imagination. And our daughter, Molly, when she said to me, you know what I'd like to do, Dad? We were talking about this, and she said, I'd like to climb Kilimanjaro with you and Mom. Now, Ellen, unfortunately, has some bad knees that won't allow her to do that climb. But when Molly said it would really be cool to climb Kilimanjaro, it's like, whoa, man, that's pretty cool. I don't know if I can do it. I need to get into better shape. But maybe we can climb some things, some hills or mountains or smaller things that are closer by, and you don't have to go to Africa. But it stimulates. One thing stimulates another thing. And when you think about goals that excite the imagination, just to prime the pump, think about if money or time or talents were not limitations, what would you do? And when you start having these discussions, do not, and I underline this, do not start when you hear an idea, is say to your partner, well, how would you do that? Because the practicality of a new idea will just kill the spark of imagination. So don't ask, how would you do that? Instead, ask, why is that exciting to you? What would you feel if you did it? Would you feel bad if you never could do something like that? Are there other things that sound close to that? So when you start, and these are things that pull us forward, and it starts giving kids the idea that our parents are alive, that we still have goals. We include kids in the process of goals that excite the imagination. And cut out pictures, put them on the refrigerator of these kinds of activities, things that you want to do, be, or have.
Patty, do I have time to add a very short thing?
Sure, please, yeah.
Which is, especially again with young kids, one of the problems that a lot of couples have is who's initiating time together. And it can get really frustrating if one parent is the one who has to initiate our time together all the time. And so something that I like to set up with couples is an agreement for one time in the week that you will do something together that actually neither person has to ask for, and that it becomes a routine part of your week. And it can be something, you know, it can be a walk at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, or it can be a coffee at a Starbucks, or, I mean, it can be a date night, but it doesn't have to be something as big as a date night. The important aspect of it is the reliability that both people make a commitment to being together. It's a time that we don't talk about problems, and we both will show up. And then if either one of us needs to change it, we'll take responsibility for working out something else. But basically, it's something that works in the week, week after week after week after week. And some couples haven't spent time together since their kids were born, and they have to learn how to be together again. And so having that reliably takes out some of the anxiety of having to request it.
You know, I just kind of as one thought, I was working with a couple one time. We were talking about family meetings and the kind of things that people could talk about, you know, the events coming up for the family and, you know, who's going to do what, who needs to go where, et cetera. And they got the kids together. And one of the parents said, well, you know, we're going to have a family meeting, but what is a family? What do you guys think a family is? And their five-year-old said, well, a family is a place that you never leave. And I thought, God, what a great description of family, a place that you never leave. So we're just really, you know, supportive of having family discussions, family interactions, and the importance of what Martin Buber, the philosopher, said, of all the conflicts I've ever had with people in my entire life, it boiled down to two things. I didn't say what I meant, and I didn't do what I said I would do. And those two principles, say what you mean and do what you say, you will reduce so much stress in a family by saying what you mean and doing what you say.
Thank you. What a good way to end here. So do you want to just let people know how they can reach the Couples Institute just very briefly?
Sure. Very easy. You can either go online and go to www.couplesinstitute.com. There's lots of wonderful free resources on our website, including a video on our home page of Pete and I negotiating a difficult issue between the two of us.
Ellen had a big project she wanted to do, and I was not that in favor of it. So it's, you know, on the top of the website, how you deal with something like that.
Or you can give us a call at 650-327-5915 or 887-327-5915.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for all of this information. Sort of as final word, what I'd like to say is that we're coming out with a self-guided video class on building a listening partnership, which is sort of an emotional resource that you can build for yourself with people of your choosing that you don't have to pay for, that can really help take, you know, help provide a place to go with the feelings that get in your way of really connecting with your children and your parenting partner and other allies in your life. And so we're at handinhandparenting.org. And if you keep an eye on our website or sign up for our newsletter, we will let you know how you can get a hold of this way to learn lots about the art of listening and the art of emotional healing.
The skills that you have at Hand in Hand are phenomenal. And I just refer so many couples to the information, the resources, and the consultation that you guys for Hand in Hand that solves so many parenting issues. It's like, oh my God, with the service that you provide is unbelievable at the price and the value. Ay, ay, ay.
And we want to thank everybody who donated to Hand in Hand for our scholarship program.
Yes.
We raised over $5,000 with this call. Thank you, Pete, and thank you, Ellen, for donating your time and your wisdom, the nuggets of help that you can offer people in a quick hour. I'm pretty amazed at what you have been able to pack in. So thank you so much for everyone.
It's our pleasure to do. It's our pleasure. Thank you for asking us.
Okay.
Yes,
all right.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks everybody for joining us.
Thank you all. And hey, listen, good luck. There's so much support out there. You're not alone in working with the challenges of parenting and your relationship. You are not alone. The resources are there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us. Hand in Hand is here to help you get the support you need for your work as a parent. To download podcasts on additional parenting topics, go to handinhandparenting.org. We look forward to connecting with you again soon.